I'd like to call to order the, our special commission meeting this afternoon, so if you'd all please rise and help me with the pledge of allegiance, I'd appreciate it.
The United States of America, and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. This is a special commission meeting today, and we're very privileged to have University of Washington being represented this afternoon, talking about urban planning. And our guest speaker today is Dr. Ann Tolfin, and she's going to be giving our presentation. So the floor is yours.
Before I start, I just want to share with you some of the brochures from the School of Urban Studies. If you have a little time. Thank you, Commissioner Johnson, and thank you to the Port Commission and to Eric Johnson for inviting me here to share with you some of the work that our students have done over the course of the last year. My name is Ann Tolfin. I'm here from the School of Urban Studies at UW-Tacoma, where I run the MA program in community planning. I am the only presenter who's here today because it's difficult to get some of our students coordinated and ready to join you, although I do want to be very clear that we hope very much that this is the beginning of a series of conversations. If any of this work interests you and you would like to talk further with the individuals who conducted it, I can absolutely put you in touch with any of the individual students, and we hope to be able to continue these conversations in smaller and less formal settings. This is an overview of my presentation today. I'm going to talk a little bit about who we are in the School of Urban Studies and more specifically in the MA program in community planning and what we do. And as corollary to that, I hope what will come across is some of what we don't do so that we're really clear about what our aims are, because I know a lot of what happens here at the Port is really quite sophisticated and oriented towards business and private models of development that are not what we do in the School of Urban Studies. I will, however, start by offering some framing questions that directed the study that the students did and some of the things that we think are really important for your stakeholder engagement and, in particular, developing broader and deeper constituencies of the people who are represented and whose interests are furthered by the Port being here in the region in the South Sound. Then I'm going to move on to the key findings, and this is where I'm working to try to condense significantly the very wonderful but slightly long presentation that we offered over at UWT in June. So I'm trying to just give the highlights, and then I wanted to take some time for next steps. I will try to be sensitive to time, and I do apologize in some ways that it is just me, so I thank you in advance for your willingness to let me come and share this with you. All by my lonesome, instead of my wonderful students, who I very much hope you have the chance to meet. So a little bit about who we are and what we do. This is the now School of Urban Studies and the master's degree in community planning, which I have had a big role in over the last couple years, but I'm joined, thankfully, by fantastic faculty colleagues, some of whom I'll talk a little bit more about in a moment. I just want to share a little bit about the genesis of this program, that when we decided to develop a degree in community planning, part of that comes from the recognition that planning in this country is pretty narrowly defined. So you're either coming from a design background and you're being taught how to develop land use plans, comprehensive plans, which, for better or worse, and I think as a planning scholar, I would say maybe worse, we don't tend to follow in the US. We're not very well empowered to follow plans. Or you're coming from a public policy background, which is also really important, but again, not necessarily always what you need in order to get change made. So in our community planning program, we are more interested in understanding community more broadly and thinking about how do we work to make change. We are a new program, so this is a photo of our first graduates last year in front of the W here at UWT. Really wonderful. We graduated 10 students, and their culminating studio project was called A Roadmap to Civic Engagement, which they conducted with the city of Tacoma. They interviewed over 60 professionals, leaders of different agencies and departments, asking about their processes of civic engagement. I mention that because I'm going to come back to it, and I think it might be relevant for some of the things that you all are facing here at the Port.
And they graduated with master's degrees, right?
They did. They graduated with master's degrees. Some of these folks are now still working in the region at public agencies, nonprofit organizations. One of them has gone on to pursue a PhD. So we're also really pleased that a lot of our grads are helping to populate the region. And I think this is part of the vision of UW-Tacoma, that we're investing in human capital and helping to drive forward the development of the South Sound. That's me in my office. We're really fortunate at UW-Tacoma to have these wonderful spaces to work in. And this, I think, really represents who we are and what we do. My colleague Mark Pendris and I at our hooding ceremony this year. It's really wonderful when we get our students to the end of their journey with us and they're, in this case, hooded or they receive their degrees. This is Haley Ann McKean, Mark Pendris and I in June. So, as I mentioned, Mark Pendris and I this year co-led the studio, and Mark was unable to join us today. His work is really more on economic and industrial development, so very much in line with what we're talking about today, whereas I am a community planning and civic engagement scholar. All of my work is on waterfronts and urban waterfronts. I co-lead a Port Cities Working Group through the Association of Pacific Rim Universities. We're meeting for the third time in Sydney. I leave a week from tomorrow. I'm really excited to be involved in that group. I co-lead with a colleague of mine at UW in Seattle. And so part of the engagement there is around the sustainable development goals, how ports and port city waterfronts can help drive forward improvements on sustainable development in this region and hopefully throughout the Pacific Rim. I also want to take a moment here and go off script just a little bit to share with you a little bit of my own background and the fact that a little bit of my story. Just to let you know that my maternal grandfather was a dock worker before he convinced the Army to take him and enlisted in World War II, used his GI benefits to start a business and raise a family of five in New Jersey. My paternal grandfather was a wheat farmer in Eastern Washington and also really kind of committed to what I think of as the backbone of a lot of the work and labor of this country. My paternal grandmother was a 1913 graduate of Washington State University. She was a school teacher until she got married to run the farm and raise the kids. And my maternal grandmother had an associate's degree in chemistry. So I think of my mother as the first college graduate in her family. But I share all of this with you to say that the commitments that I'm going to describe to you are very long-term commitments for me. They stretch back generations. And I think that's important because that is how I've understood this Port Commission. Both those of you who are seated here today and the members who are not here today, this is a long-term commitment to serve the people of this region and to think about how this port drives economic development. And I think that as we're facing elections and that we're thinking about the role that a Port Commission elected person plays, whether this is a stepping stone to the next thing, or whether this is a way to really think about how do we innovate, how do we serve the interests of the residents of this region, it's something that I think has really defined the Port Commission thus far, is that people have taken it very seriously. They've protected the institution. They've developed norms of governance. And so the question I think that I'm interested and my colleagues are interested in helping us think about together is how do we embrace the future? How do we include more people in that vision? How do we learn how to deal with climate change, engage more community members? So, a little bit about the studio, and then I promise I will get into the content and the findings. The studio runs for two terms, and rather than having individual students come to us as faculty members and tell us what they want their MA thesis to be, we try to structure a program where all of the students work together on a particular issue or topic that we think is important for this region and this place. And this year, we thought that industrial development and industrial planning is extremely important for this region and this place. So one of the ideas behind this is that we get economies of scale. Rather than a whole bunch of 40-page papers that may or may not have any relevance or immediate applicability, we try to frame out an issue and leverage the wonderful energy and person hours, frankly, of our students to try to better understand a particular issue. I do want to be clear, though, that we are academics. Even though I have little stints in my background of working in economic development and in community planning in outside of academia, at the end of the day, I'm training students. I don't run an environmental consultancy, and I don't run an economic development consultancy. So trying to think about where those interstices are, like how interest can be served, I guess I feel a strong interest in trying to say that at the end of the day, we're really interested in knowledge production and in looking at the empirics of the nature of urban development. Going back to the idea of the community planning degree, a founding tenet or ethos is the notion that there is not one community. So when we think about doing community engagement, it's not going out and choosing a particular constituency that is going to be chosen to represent the interests of, quote unquote, the community. There are lots of different communities. And starting to understand that and engage with that is really essential to doing community planning well. The second thing, and this goes back to what I alluded to earlier, is that planning is not so much a profession, you know, to have an AICP certification, although certainly many of our graduates do and will go on to get AICP certification. But the planning is really about thinking about the future. And as such, people do it in all sorts of different jobs. I would say that every port commissioner is a planner, that people throughout your entire organization are planners, whether or not they're in the planning department. And so that's also something that we're trying to cultivate and activate and think about for our students. And ultimately, the question is really, how do we take action? How do we identify pathways of action in order to create change and the kind of change that serves more people to create prosperous regions and thriving communities? Take one moment. So I don't bore you, Silly. Maybe I'll pause for a moment and ask if there's any questions so far, either from the commissioners or
you're doing great.
Audience members. Okay, so a little bit more about the studio. It's very important to me to come through loud and clear and let you all know that as the School of Urban Studies, as the MA degree in community planning, and I would say also in collaboration with our programs in urban design, in geospatial science, the certificate in GIS, the BA in sustainable urban development, which I also spent years developing and am invested in, we are not anti-industry. We are not post-industrial thinkers. We are not hoping that we are going to get rid of the smokestacks and green the city. We recognize that we need industry, that industry creates jobs, that industry creates the products that we all depend upon, that industry is part of the reality that we all live in. And so I just want to be absolutely clear that we believe in industry and we want industry in this city, and we recognize that Tacoma is a gritty and wonderful industrial home for a lot of different people. The challenge, in our view, is that we really need a shared vision for what that industry is, the different sectors that we are investing in and developing, and how we go about it.
I agree with your comment, especially your second one, because I come from industry, and over my short period of time in life, this area has kind of transformed from an industry business area into a more residential area, which puts a lot of the strain on the industry, because when you become residential, you don't want anything except houses.
Yes.
To exaggerate the point.
Right, and the housing enriches a lot of people, which is great. You know, classic analysis in urban regime theory starts with the idea of a growth machine, and that you know, your mortgage brokers are making money, your real estate professionals are making money, your construction industry is making money, and that's all great. And your tax base is rising, also not a bad thing. But if housing is becoming less and less accessible for more and more people, and you don't have the job base to run tandem with that, you're going to have a problem.
Well, and the other issue is, if I buy a house but I'm earning my money in Seattle and I'm buying a house here, then I want a residential here because I'm earning my money in Seattle, not here.
Right.
Which changes the
That dynamic. Is an issue. I absolutely agree with you. And something that's not in my slides, but it's really important and I know is felt and known by people in this room, but industry is really struggling in Seattle specifically, because the cost of doing business there keeps escalating. It's increasingly difficult for workers to live and to raise families in Seattle. And so we're really in a wonderful moment, if we think about it that way, in terms of what can we do in the South Sound to benefit from the corner that Seattle has backed themselves into, for better or worse. So the idea behind the studio, and we certainly put the students through the paces with an awful lot of literature, and we heard about it, and they were not happy about all the reading and all the policy background, but trying to set the stage for how we go about thinking about the goal of better economic outcomes, more jobs, and this is really a key point for the port and the port commission, stronger constituencies, so that the residents of this region, the people who go to the polls in November, are down with what is happening here at the Fabulich Center and in the Tide Flats. And that if we do that and we get closer to doing that and continue to do that and grow those investments, that's when we get closer to what we think of as sustainable industrial development, which again, to hit home this point, is not antithetical to sustainable development. We see industry as really part and parcel of growing economic justice, of opening pathways to prosperity for everybody in the region, and that is really what sustainability is about. So the framing questions for the studio really came out of our recognition, and I think the recognition of many people, including, I'm sure, people in this room, that the methanol plant ended up being a tremendous lightning rod for this region. That as more people came out upset about the siting of that plant, upset about the process, upset is like a, you know, very calm and polite word, angry, livid, frustrated. What are you doing? You know, that it really kind of brought to the fore maybe some long existing tensions around how people want to see their tide flats developed, what we think the future is bringing us, and the need for a deeper and more robust conversation about what industrial development is and should be in the tide flats sub area. I also want to acknowledge that in talking with folks at the Northwest Seaport Alliance, the City of Tacoma, informal conversations here, we recognize that jumping right into the sub-area planning process was probably not a wise decision for us with a 20-week studio. And so we were more interested in trying to get a handle on a lot of the issues without going to the meetings or representing ourselves as somehow involved in or formally a part of what we understand is already a very complicated process.
It is a complicated process. And one of the questions I always have is, how do you talk to a group who has no clue on how important hydrocarbons are in their everyday life? So, you know, I want to get rid of hydrocarbons. Well, you're not going to have anything in your house, and you're not going to wear anything but a wool, exaggerate the point. So, I'm against something, but I don't know how important it is in my life. So, how do you address something like that?
It's a great question, and I think you know that planning has these ties to public policy. Yeah. I was trained by a public policy scholar and political scientist, and so I'm very familiar with this divide between science and policymaking. And it's not a new problem, and it's a really challenging issue. If the science is clear and the empirics are clear that something is existing as a risk or as part of our lives, but we are unable to see it, take responsibility for it, people still act on their biases. They still act on their emotional attachments.
It's so, because they don't understand the technology behind it. Mm-hmm.
Correct. But I guess what I'm getting to, what I'm maybe suggesting that you entertain and think about is, and I'll just share that I have seen a lot of projects where people invest time and energy and money in the assumption that if they provide more science, people will change their mind. Yeah. And that does not happen. Right. So the idea of engaging with people where they're coming from emotionally and recognizing that their experience is legitimate and it informs the priorities that they have and the truths that they hold, whether it's frustrating and angering, it, I think, is a pragmatic reality around the fact that a lot of us are resistant to the role of carbon in our lives. Right. I drove here in a car today. Yeah. I put gasoline in my engine. recognizing that there is a good deal of controversy around industrial siting, that the support for industry generally is uneven, that maybe some people are not sufficiently behind the importance of industry here in the city or the different kinds of industry and whether it's how realistic it is to move on to different fuel platforms. Understanding those risks, the costs and the benefits, and recognizing that those are constructed kind of positions that people have. Also recognizing that a lot of the development that is championed and chased by cities leads to gentrification. So this goes to your earlier point, that as we're developing housing, as those housing price points rise, as we're turning former industrial lands into pretty parks and really lovely entertainment districts, that serves people with money. It serves what we call the creative class professionals, which you want in your city in many ways because they have money to burn, they're well educated, they invest in the civic infrastructure in theory, However, they drive up prices and they push out other uses. And so this process of displacement is one that Tacoma is also in a moment to be able to really try to do a better job of not becoming the next Seattle, which is now trying to not become the next San Francisco, right? The other, and really I think most important point here is around inclusivity and ongoing engagement with diverse constituents. So when I told you at the outset of this presentation that both of my grandmothers went to college, it has taken generations for me to be able to have a career that has spanned my lifetime, and that I'm able, my children know what I do, I'm able to contribute to my household income. I bring that up because we have a lot of forms of oppression and structural ways in which people have not taken part in, and they have been locked out of the economic benefits of port development for years and for generations. I'm talking about the presence and the position of the Puyallup tribe. I'm talking about the presence and the position of the African American community in this city. I'm talking about the presence and the position of immigrant communities in this city. People who are invested in and have long-standing commitments to and an interest in the thriving well-being of our commons, who maybe have not had the same amount of access to jobs and to resources. And so this is a problem from a normative standpoint in terms of who do we want to be as a democracy and as a region. It's also a very practical problem if people feel excluded and oppressed when you're trying to get a new project passed. So I want to bring up that issue of inclusivity and ongoing engagement to say it is, in my view, possibly and probably the most important thing that the port needs to prioritize in pursuing these new and different forms of industrial development, potentially. And I'll talk a little bit more about some of those opportunities in a moment. Finally, I want to say that in the studio project, we did encourage the students to think about the Thayer Foss Waterway as a transition zone, recognizing that the port-owned lands themselves are not for us to think about what we want to do with, and also the fact that the Thayer Foss really exists geographically in its physical disposition between a rapidly redeveloping downtown with this wonderful thriving cultural district where the UWT is, where the museums are, and a really thriving industrial port. So, and I know that this idea of the Thayer Foss as a transition zone way predates my presence here in Tacoma, that this has been recognized by people in this room and elsewhere as a really important point. I think the presence of urban waters there, as I understand it, is part of this vision, like how can we kind of create this space where we're trying to grow new industry and protect the port. And so I want to say that we're down with that. We want to further that vision. And so part of what we're trying to think about is how do we do that?
Could I make a couple of comments on your inclusivity and ongoing engagement with diverse constituents? That's actually what's happening here now is with Eric Johnson as our new CEO, we're about to embark upon a strategic planning process. And what's nice to hear is you're really confirming, I think, one of the tenets that Eric, as a new person to this institution, is saying, we've got to do more of that. We've got to get it right. And so I'm very pleased that Eric has already picked up on that issue without even hearing your presentation. And I'm sorry, or maybe you did, Eric, but the reality is that's a key tenet, as I read what your description was trying to achieve on the outline you gave to us here the other day. So I really think you're right on the mark. And the other thing I think is what I liked about the student study focus was when it first started out, it was sub-area planning, which was too broad.
Yeah.
And I agree, even though I'm a little bit biased on the Foss Waterway, but the reality is I'm glad that you focused in on that particular piece of real estate because it's a little more understandable from, I think, a student standpoint.
I think so. And I think our hope here also is that, look, this was a challenging project also, I'm not going to lie, that we threw our arms a little bit wide. And so it was frustrating for students. Like, wait, who's our client? Like, are we going to see anything get done at the end of this? Like, so I would say that for me next year, like, it's really important to me to kind of carve out, and we want to continue on this theme, but to carve out a project where everybody feels like they see the fruits of it, right? That, like, the students are directly interacting with a client partner and working through a scope together, that there's a project that we formulate that actually gets done and built, that then they feel like, that's what I did when I was in graduate school at UW-Tacoma. I helped to make that happen. The challenge for us, and I'll come to this in a moment, and you probably know this as well, there's not, the practice of industrial planning is very ad hoc, right? So in planning, people talk about residential planning, they talk about retail planning, they talk about commercial development, right? Like the Urban Land Institute has like a thriving commercial development section. The field of industrial planning, I think many cities and regions have really failed to invest in it deeply and kind of visibly. So that was also challenging for us. We're effectively saying to students, we want you to help us push this up to the foreground.
I think that's a good idea because, you know, one of the things we overlook sometimes is the qualifications people have to have in order to participate. And that holds some holds some groups back because they aren't technically qualified. That can be overcome.
Right.
And the other thing is to recognize where the money is really made. The money is made more industrial. People who work in industry generally make a lot more money than people who work in light manufacture or commerce or marketing sales. And so you take a high school graduate who works in industry or has been, they can make a lot of money mm-hmm. compared to warehousing.
Yeah. So I guess one of the things we're also thinking about is like where and how might industrial planning help the Thea Foss bring more jobs and kind of protect port operations. So when we ask students to look at that zone, and to think of it as a buffer between downtown and heavy industrial uses, one of the tasks, and that'll come out in these subsequent slides, is we were asking them to identify new environmental and industrial uses that could spur innovation. And so I'll talk a little bit about some of what they came up with. This is what I was alluding to. As a planning scholar, who's somebody who conferences with planners, I can tell you, this is a really thin literature. Like there's a couple of different studies that we relied on really heavily. In the whole new urbanist movement, anti-sprawl movement, it's really kind of shocking how few people have thought about the role of industry in promulgating sprawl, that it's actually cheaper to have a light manufacturing facility out on the fringes of a metropolitan area than it is in the downtown, and that that's driving the sprawl just as surely as the residential sprawl. Like, right. We hear a lot about the tract homes. Yeah. We don't hear as much about the fact that the jobs that those people are going to are now spread all over the region. So it is surprising in many ways that it's such a thin literature. Also, we think of it as kind of an ad hoc practice, which is not to say that there aren't people doing it and doing it really well. Like, for instance, aerospace here in Washington State is very well empowered, right? Like you have the constituent industries that support a company like Boeing. The question and the argument that we see is that despite the presence and the really wonderful work of incubators and different groups of manufacturing associations, having a kind of long-term strategy for advocacy and linking that up with land use seems to be something that is a pretty significant opportunity. Other things that we see in the industrial planning field, and again, when we start talking about planning, in planning more generally, we have this bias towards design, that it's really fun and sexy to do something new and to design a new downtown space as opposed to thinking about the presence and existing assets of industrial strength and building on that. We well know that there's a tendency to chase industrial firms, and the firms then pit cities against each other and they pit states against each other. Termed smokestack chasing. And the very long-standing discourse of jobs versus the environment, that if you want jobs, you have to trash the environment. If you want to save the environment, you have to get rid of jobs. We've seen that in Tacoma over the course of decades and we've seen in cities across the U.S. So trying to get past those things to just really elevate and emphasize the fact that work is really the backbone of communities and that we can have all the great parks and housing and services in the world, but they all require jobs to work. So to speak. So I've had the benefit and the really great opportunity to think more about ports and port districts. So as somebody with government administration training. I sometimes get kind of dorky interest in how budgets work and how public financial management comes about. But the Port District, as a creature of the state that has tremendous bonding ability, development capacity, also has faced tremendous pressures, as I know you are well versed with. So this is a little bit tricky for me. I'm talking to the experts about something that I've just kind of danced around. But I do want you to know that we did make an effort to share with our students the fact that the Tacoma Port has done an incredible job of protecting its core business in maritime trade and container cargo shipping. That where we see port districts around the country who have either been forced to or have chosen to diversify into all kinds of other forms of economic development to justify their existence. They've got cruise ship terminals. They've got pleasure districts and retail districts. They've got property spread all across the city doing all sorts of different things. But the Port of Tacoma is really quite extraordinary in the way that they have maintained and protected that primary business.
In fact, we're in the process of spending $1 billion to modernize our Northwest Seaport Alliance so we can keep the same business.
Well, and so the Seaport Alliance also, I would say, the collaboration in order to compete, right? And so looking at the Long Beach, LA grouping and recognizing that with the widening of the Panama Canal and the need to try to keep business coming here as opposed to thinking of Savannah as a viable alternative or places on the East Coast that once upon a time didn't even enter into thinking, how do we compete with the Canadian ports? How do we keep that cargo business coming here?
Do you get in the economics of some of those discussions?
I'm not sure if I get all of the economics of it, but I recognize that, like, that's the bread and butter, right?
Because every port's funded differently, and we all have economic pressures from a competition standpoint also.
Right. And I mentioned earlier that I'm an athlete. Like, I like to compete, and I get the competitive piece of it as well. I think, again, coming back to the constituency building and stakeholder engagement, more people are going to ask the question, who's benefiting? So in Los Angeles, Long Beach, we know that a lot of that cargo traffic gets redistributed into an enormous economy in the South Bay area, or in SoCal more generally. So there's a multiplier effect. Whereas a lot of the cargo that comes through our port gets right on out of here. And so I think people start to wonder when they really pull through the numbers, okay, we have this tremendous volume of trade, what are we getting out of it, right? When you look at automation, when you look at the total number of longshoring jobs that the port does or doesn't have, there's both a question of how many people are being put to work and in what ways, and then who's getting those jobs that are available? And do we see kind of diverse constituencies of people who are represented in that workforce? Because they're good jobs, right? Like, they pay an awful lot more and are more reliable than getting a job at a restaurant or at Point Rustin. So really foregrounding this question of who benefits, particularly if this port is deciding that they don't want to become a port that develops a Point Rustin as their kind of offshoot economic development model, what is the thing that the port invests in to say to their constituents, we're benefiting everybody and here's what we're doing? So this led us to some challenges that we asked our students to look at. And so this is where I'm really getting into the student work. And I hope I'm not pressing up too much on time. I think I'm doing okay. Place attachment and historical tensions are where I'm going to start, partially because I think these are some of the most robust and interesting findings that the students came up with. It's very much in line with what we do in community planning. And I'll be honest with you, it's also in line with how I was trained as an interpretive and qualitative researcher. So what we asked students to do was to take the public comments from the interim tide flat regulations over 700 pages and do a coding exercise to try to understand, what are people mad about? What are they saying? What are their top issues? So I'm going to talk about those in a moment. Talk a little bit about public access to industrial shorelines. We recognize that there are real reasons, whether it's homeland security, whether it's liability, whether it's just inconvenient and not wanting to deal with it. I mean, there's lots of reasons to not have lots of people in your backyard as an industrial owner. There's also lots of reasons to do it. So we want to talk a little bit about that, and that goes to that stakeholder engagement and constituency building. Some of the work was focused on where is the industrial growth happening? Where might it be happening? So I'll talk a little bit about Industry 4.0. The issue of land use and transportation access. There are lots of groups who are going to provide anybody who's looking to invest in a region with available commercial sites, with available housing sites. It's a little bit trickier maybe if you're a small business owner or an industrial investor trying to figure out where and how can I invest in or grow a business in Tacoma. Environmental health, a couple of pilot projects that students identified on the FOSS, and then I'm going to finish up by talking just a little bit about institutional arrangements. Again, across all of these, it is not my intent, nor was it the students' intent ever, to try to criticize what is happening in this organization. We are thinking about the process and the opportunity of engaging more deeply with your stakeholders. So to start with stakeholder engagement, this project was undertaken by Karis Min and Jennifer Nguyen, two students who just finished their master's degrees. Karis runs a firm called Talitha Consulting and has continued to do more of this kind of work, as well as working with other constituencies. Their question was, how do community-focused emotions, behaviors, and ideas of place attachment influence industrial development? So again, going through those public comments, over 700 pages, and coding them line by line for specific text, what we call text strings, that really start to evidence what people care about, what's getting them going. We use something called In Vivo qualitative software to help us organize that data and kind of form it into sets. Based on the questions that they asked, they identified over 100 open codes. They formulated those into axial codes and then produced selective codes, which are, in effect, the findings. Three main findings, and I hope I'm doing service to their findings as I present them here. I can share with you the report when it's done in about a month, and it goes into much more detail. The first one, as people talked about attachment to the tide flats and kind of finding the text that responded to those questions, which, by the way, I want to point out that one of the preeminent scholars in place attachment is at UW-Seattle. Her name is Lynn Manzo. This is a field of environmental psychology that recognizes that people's relationship to their built environment is really important in motivating their behavior. So the kinds of bonds that we form with places, whether it's our workplace, if you're working on the docks, whether it's through kayaking or different things, that those connections motivate our commitments. They get us out. They will get us out with placards at a protest. They will get us to write a letter. They might a project from getting built is really my overall point here too. So one of the first things to understand about place attachment, according to these students, is that they're not simple. That a lot of the folks who took the time to write a letter recognize that there are coexisting concerns. They might be concerned about fossil fuel use, but they're also concerned about jobs and about the future of the region. So they recognize that these things are, in fact, quite complicated. The second thing, we call that ambivalence, the first one. So an ambivalence, it's not like whatever. It's like, you know, both of these things are motivating my connections to this place simultaneously, and they don't necessarily live together nicely. The second one is involvement, that people want to be involved in creating the future. They take a lot of pride in being part of a region that is building towards something. They want to be engaged and listened to. They frequently talked about wanting to feel a sense of belonging, feel attached to what was happening in the tide flats. These students coded these comments by zip code to illustrate a second piece of involvement, which is that your active stakeholders, and I say you, this is the city as well, I recognize, but thinking about the tide flats as the space of engagement, really are culled from a couple of places predominantly. So you see North Tacoma with the highest number of comments there, the Northeast Tacoma and stretching into University Place. So it really highlights an issue with letter writing and public comments as a way of seeking engagement, that you're not necessarily engaging the whole of your constituency across the county.
Can you, both on the board and in my copy, I can't read that. Can you give me there's two charts in here that I'm interested in.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
Can you give me a copy that I can read it?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Yep. And there's a good deal more data in the actual report. So it'll have these charts and also some of the kind of justifications and analysis.
Okay.
The third one is stewardship, that people want to do what's right. They see this as a shared resource. They want to be part of protecting it, whether it is the economic strength of the port or the environmental health and resiliency of the region, that people see this as theirs in a good way, we think. And so the takeaways in our view, on place attachment. When we think about their three main findings, that with these the coexisting concerns of the bonds that people have, people know it's complicated to make these decisions. They want to be part of creating the future. And there is a sense of shared responsibility to really think about place attachment as a resource, and that these bonds, if they're explored and activated and built upon, can really serve the interests of the port and the Port Commission. The second group that did a text analysis of the public comments was looking more specifically at the conflicts. What are the conflicts that surface repeatedly over time with respect to the development in the tideflats? Which I think, you know, right? Like, things that come to the fore in your mind are probably a lot of the things that were in the public comments that the students noticed. Christine Komen, who works at the Hilltop Action Coalition, and Leslie Mintaraga, who is a parent and an educator, also lives here in Tacoma. Their project, also combing through the public comments, found three themes, same basic methodology. The first one is that people recognize that the economy is changing, that what worked in the past will not necessarily work in the future, whether this is automation, whether this is a shrinking number of available jobs altogether, that there is sometimes a short-term thinking that preempts any kind of long-term visioning or thinking about what's best for the region. The recognition that past pollution has been a big part of what this community has worked hard to get beyond, that it's been costly and committed to clean up the environment in Tacoma, and that leaves people wanting to think very proactively and intentionally about what's next so they don't find themselves in a similar position. We talk about recognize that we're seeking transitions, but people want justice in those transitions. The second thing around tension and conflict, and this again is a kind of like collation of different codes and text strings that people found, is that there are real trade-offs. Your constituents know this, that sometimes there are not win-win solutions. That if you do one thing, sometimes it means you cannot actually do the other thing. That something's got to give, so that on certain issues, such as health and safety, environmental justice, that these force hard decisions, and your constituents, if they're engaged in what those choices are going to be able to live with them more readily because they will understand more deeply the trade-offs involved, because we all make trade-offs, right? Like, we make them in our household budgets, we make them in all sorts of facets of our lives. So I think that on your point earlier about recognition of the difficulty of living with products from a carbon economy, that sometimes when we're forced to grapple with those things, we do in fact recognize, like, oh, okay, like, I'm gonna keep driving, am I gonna ride my bike, like these sorts of things. But that in fact your stakeholders, they get it, or they might get it if they get more information. And
they'll still buy the car.
Yeah, yeah.
They'll still drive Touché. It.
They'll still drive it. Still buy the motorhome.
And just so I'm absolutely clear that I'm not in here on a kind of, I hope, a political errand, or that I'm not like forcibly occupying one side or the other of the political spectrum, there is real concern about the legitimacy and the consistency and the enforceability of regulations. Why are they there? Why are they sometimes followed and sometimes not? So that could run the gamut. Everyone, you know, from somebody who says, wait a minute, this small business is my livelihood, it's my retirement, you're regulating me out of existence, what am I gonna leave to my children? That's more of a kind of classic property rights, you know, individualistic perspective, to somebody that you might think of as more on the left-hand side of the spectrum, who says we should be regulating everything more and more aggressively and more consistently. That across the board, what we saw as a kind of common thread here is that the regulatory environment needs to be transparent and consistent so that everybody knows what the rules of the game are, and then they can plan and invest accordingly.
One of the problems, I agree with that 100%, but part of the problem is the rules sometimes have been set for a long time. They're very apparent. You just started up today.
Right.
So you're told, it's not that they're not there. They're not apparent because you're unaware of them, and because you've been absent for the last 20 years and you just showed up today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we see this in planning all the time, and a great example is the Growth Management Act. And you may be familiar with how controversial Proctor Station was when it was built in the North End. And people are like, what's going on? My parking, my views, it's so crowded. That has been a designated growth center since the early 90s.
Yeah.
So it's been on the books. Like, it was kind of workshopped in community meetings. It went through all the proper channels in terms of, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's. But sometimes when something comes to fruition, people are caught off guard by it. Or there might be a regulation on the books that is not being enforced. So if the practice is running counter to the policy, then people are actually justified in thinking, well, wait a minute, like, this is common practice. Everybody's doing this.
Well, I think part of the problem is people have busy lives. You come home from work, you drove an hour to get home, your kids are playing soccer today, you're doing all this stuff, and all of a sudden there's that building next door.
Right.
And it's hard to, people,
it's hard to keep up
people, with everything. People make no attempt to keep up except from in reality until something starts to show up.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a hard thing to overcome.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And the final thing, and this really gets back to inclusivity and the processes of engagement, is this anger and confusion about process. Well, wait, if that was a policy, how come I didn't know it? Or when was that approved? And who was representing my interests? And so this process of, like, who gets to make these decisions captured a lot of different veins of comments, one of which really came around to the idea of being socially responsible, that one person's definition of socially responsible might be around job growth and industrial strength, and another person's definition of socially responsible might be around environmental regulation and public health. And so the very definition of terms like that is somewhat contested. We also did find a lot of anger about fossil fuels and fossil fuel use and the recognition that climate change is real, that this region is vulnerable, that investments that perpetuate forms of economic development that may in fact be vulnerable to disaster in the future and or contributing to the ongoing destruction of the climate and the planet increasingly are really upsetting to people. All of these point to the need for more concerted inclusive planning, which we all know, and I'm not gonna lie to you, is expensive, it's complicated, it's difficult to do well, and it's not always successful. So I'm not trying to offer a panacea of, like, have more meetings and everything will be great. Mm-hmm. It is a very complicated process to engage people more deeply in all of these issues. So I want to be absolutely clear about that. That process about how do you build the trust and the programs and the relationships where people are able to learn together and understand alternative viewpoints is one of the more complicated things that we deal with. Any of us, anywhere. On these historical tensions, as I said, we know things are changing. So the question is, can we be proactive? That hard choices have to be made, and everyone pays for growth, whether it is directly through their taxes or whether it is in the cost to the environment that we all share. But not everybody has equal access to the process and its benefits. So this is the problem of unequal economic development and rising inequality that the South Sound experiences as well as other regions. Our overall kind of suggestion here is that conflict needs to be engaged. It's not going to go away, and in many cases, it's going to get worse. Public access and industrial shorelines. This is Riley Bushnell and Alyssa Torres. Riley has recently taken a job in Idaho as a planner in Coeur d'Alene and left us recently. Alyssa Torres works for PBS here in Tacoma and recently joined the Planning Commission in the city of Tacoma. Their question of can industrial shoreline use and public waterway access coexist to build appreciation for industry, strengthen stakeholder constituencies? This is a little bit of a pet issue for me. I've looked at it somewhat in the Stakeholder Management Act Shoreline Management Act and Shoreline Master Program update here in Tacoma, stretching back years. We recognize that there's a strong resistance to having public access in industrial shorelines, not just in Tacoma, all over Washington State and different areas. And so one of the things that these students were interested in examining were places where access and industrial uses coexist and how that came about. So some of the benefits of that kind of coexistence might include building more of a visual and experiential appreciation for industrial presence and use, as opposed to something that's way at a distance, you get kind of drawn into the mechanics of it. You see the beauty of a crane operating, or the elegance of an industrial process, and you appreciate it more. Maybe you're more willing to go to bat for it, or you can picture it as a place of work, not a place of productivity. So what we asked them to do as a kind of initial step here was to take a few case examples. They identified six, and to look at how those public access points came about, how they were funded, was there a policy that supported them, and from what they could tell, whether there was an impact. I do want to acknowledge that I think this is an area that really just kind of scraped the surface, that there's an awful lot more work here that could be done that looks at more specific instances if there were things that you all wanted to know about that got into more detail about funding mechanisms or the visits that people made or the impacts on adjacent businesses. This group looked at economic development, and I want to be clear here also that we are not an economic program. So I think a lot of what interested them was kind of veering into a field that we had not yet really introduced in our curriculum. And thinking about industrial development, they did interviews with people regionally at different incubators, at the Chamber of Commerce and their Makers program. But there's an awful lot more work here that could be done. I think, you know, Workforce Central came out with a report earlier this week that looks specifically at automation and the different constituencies that are not benefiting from job growth in the region. But really we were asking them to look at Industry 4.0 as the kind of fourth industrial revolution and to think about whether or how that could become a priority on the East Foss. So we think of Industry 4.0 as cleaner, more equitable, more sustainable jobs. On this one in particular, I would say I'm going to need to direct you to the report and encourage you to look at some of the case studies that they pulled out from Portland, from Oakland, the advocacy and activism of different people in those regions who are pushing forward the role of women, the role of people of color, protecting those constituencies in job growth and making sure that it's a shared economy and shared prosperity. They did a wonderful presentation. Anastasia Kale led off by talking about these industrial revolutions. Neelam, let me tell you a little bit about the students also. Neelam Ranhawa works at Tacoma Community College and has a background in banking. And Drew Sorensen here on the right, I love seeing him there with his son because it also makes me think about the next generation and building economies that are going to support into the future. So looking, and again, this won't be news to any of you, like moving through the kind of initial investments in mechanization to mass production and assembly lines as a kind of second revolution, to then get to automated production, computers, IT systems, and robotics that we're now in the midst of Industry 4.0, or the smart factory, autonomous systems, Internet of Things, machine learning. That these are, it's both a wonderful, brave new world of automation, but it also raises a need for very specific job skills, and the way in which that's going to grow jobs is not going to be the same way that we saw jobs growing in Industry 3.0.
It creates another, I agree with you 100%, because you have to define what is a living wage. And very few people have that defined. So does it mean two incomes per household to make the average living wage? And what kind of jobs are we recruiting from a pay stakes? And it also creates a situation, have I improved the have versus have not situation, or have I made it worse?
Right. And I think on the...
That's because of education.
Industry 4.0, I mean, I have to say, it's something that we would like to continue to be part of thinking about and working through from an urban studies perspective in terms of land use, in terms of equity and the specific demographic groups that are supported and kind of enabled in processes of development. But I think it's also potentially, and I hope I'm not stepping out of line by saying this, an area for potential partnership between School of Engineering, the Milgard School, like that there's a way in which perhaps as a campus we might be thinking about these things together.
Yeah. Well, and you have to get people in school who are not in school.
There.
and who don't want to go.
Right.
Because there's a large section that doesn't want to do it.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they're 35 years old and they've been left out and they're behind.
Right. Well, to make a plug also for why it's about training, and that land use actually becomes really important as well. Like, just in kind of anecdotal conversations that I've had with entrepreneurs who talk about growing their business or wanting a place to locate, recognizing that they are being pushed out of a space in Seattle, and maybe they've got a new kind of engine for boats and they really want to manufacture, or they have a fabrication facility for apparel, that's like waterborne, that there are jobs in factories that if there was a place where they could reliably gain financing to create facilities and there was like a there, that there might potentially be an opportunity for this city in this region. And the other thing that I'll come back to at the end of the presentation, I know that you know that we are looking at the potential for a major transit station adjacent to the Tacoma Dome or connected to the Tacoma Dome. And so what does a transit-oriented development look like? It's very much de rigueur in planning to talk about mixed use, and it's about retail, and it's about housing. Well, why not a manufacturing TOD, right? Like, why aren't we thinking about transit-oriented development to serve workers, to serve factories? So all those people don't, well, why not? And so I think, like, when we think about opportunities for innovation, linking it up with transportation and linking it up with, like, just because there's a kind of status quo approach, that these things really can and should and might intersect around growing.
That's an excellent subject. So why wouldn't we go to Seattle Boeing and make sure that the light rail went by Boeing so Boeing employees could get off there? There's 100,000 employees. Why wouldn't we address that?
I think it's well worth talking about. And that kind of links into the group that I call Yulu and Tony on the right. I was trying to go alphabetically, and Yuman on the left. We're asking questions about land use and kind of in a preliminary way looking at the East Theophos to try to understand what it might look like to have a kind of ready representation of transportation, water use, and property use that would enable you to be thinking about access in those ways. So this is one place. I said it was a thin literature. A couple of scholars who work in this area, Nancy Lee is one of them, and put out a report for the APA on industrial and manufacturing planning. Scott Dempwolf is the final author there. They talk about key factors if you want to do industrial planning well, and it seems kind of like natural that you would prioritize these things. So you do an inventory of your existing industrial lands, that you're identifying their existing zoning uses and any conversions that have taken place. You understand ownership. And key here is access to transportation and infrastructure. So whether it is trucking, rail, but also how do your workers get to and from, right? And then engagement across stakeholders, they identify as a really important topic. So taking that as a starting point, this is a very general schematic that these two students worked up. Again, these are not GIS students, they're not mapping students, but they wanted to point out, and they worked with Emma Slager, who's one of our new faculty members in GIS, as a kind of way of looking at visually private ownership, City of Tacoma ownership, Port of Tacoma ownership, where is the railroad, where are the bus stops, where is there a walkable trail, and recognizing, and again, like maybe this, you all know this, you've lived and worked here for years, but for an investor coming in, this is the kind of information that people are really interested in being able to access fairly readily. Environmental health. This group was looking at the idea of a demonstration project on the East Foss that makes the port and or other stakeholders really visible in their commitment to the community and to spearheading environmental innovation. So I also want to take a moment here, and maybe I should have done this when we talked about public access. I know that the port has made really significant investments in, for instance, the Circle of Water site, reinvesting in green spaces in your land. So I do want to acknowledge that. I am not here to criticize what the port has done thus far. I think that you've done really tremendous things in supporting public access. But these students were trying to look at what else was being done in other sites and to think about properties that might enable more visibility. It's hard to get to some of these public access points within the portlands. Not a lot of your constituents maybe are aware of them or see them or come to them regularly. So these students came up with two different ideas. The first of which, green stormwater infrastructure, and they were specifically looking at that site on the Wheeler Osgood. We know that one of the largest and most successful green stormwater infrastructure sites is out in Point Defiance, so the region is already leading on this. What might it look like to build a facility that cleans the water, that maybe involves oyster texture? So the students talked about a reef of oysters to help clean the water. And specifically on this one also, they were talking about contracting procedures and making sure that the work both in the design and the construction documentation, as well as the construction itself, goes to local firms, that it helps to support particularly firms owned by people of color and puts people to work here in this city that have maybe historically been left out of these developments. And even getting as far into the idea of partnering between small local firms and larger national and international environmental engineering firms, which oftentimes get these contracts and they can run into the millions of dollars. But if you're not also trying to train people so that they can compete in the next iteration for this kind of work, that also would build your economy. That if somebody gets an opportunity to work on a project locally, then they can bid on a project in Bend or in Peoria or wherever.
Having done very major personal capital projects of $50, $100 million a crack, you do not want to experiment with somebody who's never done the job. It's like you don't want your bypass surgeon to be, oh, this is my first bypass surgery.
Right.
So you get into these grandiose kind of comments, and then you get back to the reality. I have X amount of money, and I need to make sure somebody's there who knows what they're doing, because when they're not qualified.
Don, I could not agree with you more. And I think that's a very real phenomenon. That's why I mentioned the idea of partnering,
not color.
Right? Like, and I would say in my line of work, like I don't like to be asked to do a project that I'm not sufficiently trained or skilled to do. It's not gratifying. It's not satisfying.
But some
people
don't
want to hire me again. So I'm talking about like a partnering arrangement where let's say a CH2M Hill or an EDAW partners with a local firm and says, you may not be like the most prestigious and well-known, so it's almost like an apprenticeship arrangement that I think protects the investment of the funder at the same time that it's investing in the professional development of a local firm. That's getting into like super nitty-gritty detail, I recognize.
It does, because the funder wouldn't necessarily have the expertise to do it anyway, so it has to rely on a major firm to do that.
Absolutely.
Then you always worry about, is that driving up my cost or is that not driving? Because there's always limited funds for any kind of a
Absolutely. The reason why I do get into the details on things like this is that, again, as somebody in planning and having a concern around inclusion and building broader constituencies, we all know that just getting more people at the table is not always the answer. It's like necessary but not sufficient. So if like the first pass is we need more diverse representation at decision-making tables, yeah, okay, good. But that often sometimes gets into practices of tokenism. And so questions around contracting, around that, for a lot of people, like that's where the rubber meets the road, and really like developing skills that people can continue to build on and share.
Yeah, I agree. When I was working, I always practiced using local vendors, contractors, whenever possible, even if we had to pay a little bit more.
Yeah.
It was part of the social license.
Yeah. So the other idea that the students came up with for this site really builds deeply into the industrial idea. And also the problem of the carbon-based economy, waste stream. They identified a company called Precious Plastics that's based in Europe, and there's much more information about this in the report. But really looking at post-consumer plastic recycling, both as a site to collect this waste, but then to refabricate into new and different products. Okay, 5 minutes, thank you.
Is the report complete?
Almost.
Okay, so
right after
you're
Labor
gonna
Day.
Give it to us when it's done?
Yes.
Okay,
yes,
go
indeed.
Ahead.
This is my last section, so thank you for bearing with me. The students, Liza Higby Robinson, Jeff Hilton, and Rayshawn Stevens, were asked to please look at the IGA and the way that the different institutional entities are intersecting in the tide flats, recognizing first and foremost that this is not an area of widespread knowledge. And so these are not policy experts, they are not lawyers. We just ask them to in a very preliminary sense, help us create a graphic or kind of sketch out the broad terms that would help more of the public understand the fact that different people have different responsibilities, and there are reasons for that. So whether it is the tribal sovereignty and the affirmation of their rights on their reservation lands and their traditional fishing rights to begin with, or whether it is the city's land use discretion over things that are not permitted in the tide flats, or whether it is the port's process and presence as a creature of the state. Just understanding in a kind of basic way the flow chart, we recognize that many of us in this region, many people who have otherwise busy lives, are advanced and high-functioning professionals, may or may not understand where and how decisions get made around the tide flats. And so this also is an area that we think maybe deserves more investment, to have a couple of infographics or to have something that can be circulated either within organizations or in specifically more broadly in the community, to help them understand who does what, who has the power to do what, who has the responsibility to do what. Again, just coming back to the idea that we see what we do as community-based learning and research. We are not the consultant that you hire with a kind of, well, sometimes we can execute on specific projects, but that we're interested in leveraging the assets of the university and the knowledge and the research that is conducted by people across disciplines to help further your aims, and also to think about how do we train our students to be better community planners moving forward. I'll just finish with this slide of two of our students graduating, because it brings me joy and happiness. It's really nice to get to the end of the year sometimes when we actually get to graduate these folks. I realize this is a long presentation. I really appreciate your patience. It's a Friday afternoon in the middle of August, so it's so nice that you were willing to come here. I hope it's the beginning of a series of conversations, and less formal conversations, conversations where I've been able to share with you the full written report, where you can sit down with some of our students, where you might say, here's a piece of this we think we'd like to see more of, those sorts of things. With that, I'll finish. I don't know if we have time for questions or comments.
I have one question on the report part of it. It seems to me, you know, the categories that your students are studying, and you've given us some kind of general information, but when it comes down to their actual report, before you make it final, it would seem to me it might be wise to have a draft copy presented to us so that we could point out perhaps inaccuracies or give some feedback before you finalize a report, rather than finalize something and we end up coming back and saying, you got that totally wrong. You don't understand that concept.
I totally appreciate where you're coming from. And I wish, so, and I would say that it would be wonderful if we had a kind of arrangement going into the next year, sure, where we knew that you were our client and you were saying to us, here's what we want. Because right. One of my problems right now is these students are gone.
They're gone. Right? Yeah, I don't see them
like,
here. So.
It was already hard in May to be like, okay, I need you to rewrite this. And that's they're like, they I have a job gone. Interview. And I'm, and so unless I rewrite their stuff for them, which okay. like...
All right.
So...
I was just trying to be helpful as no. to how the report might be have more relevance or be acceptable.
I do have real concerns about putting something out there that is inaccurate.
Correct.
Or that is antagonizing to people. Well, that
I don't necessarily mind antagonizing. You know,
yes.
Different perspectives, a different viewpoint. Don't really have a problem with that. But if there's a narrative that doesn't have any support,
yeah.
evidence to support it, that's questionable, or if there's inaccuracies,
right.
Then it doesn't help anybody.
I would be very appreciative, and so if we could share with you a draft, that'd be terrific.
One thing I'd like to, you know, a suggestion as we go down the road, because I went to a strategic planning thought process here a few weeks ago, and it was just like me and motherhood and apple pie and a piece of my time. Kind of ideas, and yet I only have $10.
Mm-hmm.
And I think any study would be enhanced as we go forward if people took an issue of the cost factor and who's paying.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody wants something unless they pay for it. As long as I'm paying for it, they're happy to have it. But if they have to pay for it, they're not quite as happy. So you need to bring some reality to a lot of the planning process, because you can have anything you want if you're willing to pay for it. So I think that adds to their educational level also, because they understand, they have a better understanding of what some of the roadblocks might be.
Absolutely.
Where's that money going to come from? Are people really going to vote? You know, I've lived here long enough to see the state vote for teacher raises. And then when the tax bill came around, they voted it down. So that reality is good for everybody.
Right.
And so I think as you go forward, having, I know it's hard to get the finance, but getting some broad idea of the costs, who's paying for it, and I think that's a good idea.
Absolutely. No, I think I 100% agree with that. And I think thinking of it in that kind of staged iterative way is really useful, because I think it would be, it would not necessarily help us to say, well, we shouldn't even talk about these things if we don't have a payment plan set up.
Because some things are really small.
Right.
And they can have tremendous benefits. They don't really cost a lot of money.
Right.
Some things are just huge.
But right.
Going forward to your next class.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if we could look at it and say, this area, that area, I'd like to see more on, because
right.
I think you've struck something interesting there, or at least give you our feedback on that. That might be helpful.
That would be terrific. And I want to say, like, I'm very open to saying, like, so we would develop a scope of work, perhaps, and then if part of the scope is how does this get paid for, like identifying, like, whether it's in, looking supply chains and how
things work. You're looking over the next 10 years, not the next 6 months or year or two. You're looking over a longer period of time.
Correct. And I would say that I have an interest in that, because, like, I don't want to end up in my career with 10 years worth of reports, none of which ever got built or done,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, so I both want to train my students to be able to get things done, but I personally would like to see some things, like, have those kinds of legs.
Okay. Eric, did you have a comment?
I do. I don't want to get out over my skis or get in front of the commission, but with my background in public policy and environmental and land use policy, ports, economics, politics, it's been hard for me to sit still here. I've been wanting to jump in and ask questions all the way along, but I've resisted doing that a bit. I'm looking forward to talking to you later. But one of the things that I've been clear about with the commission so far, and they haven't told me no, is that one of the areas that we would like our strategic plan to address is what I'm going to call profile or needs assessment from Pierce County's higher education institutions, because we haven't put a lot of thought into that prior to this. We have a lot of valuable resources out there in Pierce County. The UWT is obviously one of the premier ones. And the port has not, to my knowledge, really sat down and thought through what do these partnership opportunities look like? What kind of things are we looking for?
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of resource opportunities does the higher ed community offer back? And so that's a discussion that I think is going to be productive to have as we move forward through 2020.
That'd be great.
And there'll be a lot of other things we're going to talk about too. But I'd leave you with the fact that I think there's some real opportunities over the next 16 months.
Great.
To make progress in areas that are right along the line of what the commissioners are talking about.
I got three comments. First of all, the thing I want to convey, and to you and Mark, and the students, unfortunately, aren't here, but Mark isn't either, but a sincere thank you for your efforts on this topic. I think it's a very relevant kind of it was not just an academic exercise, but I think it's a good way for us to understand better what the community's thinking about. So I appreciate that very much. Second item, I think the topics that you've covered are reflective of the real issues, whether, your title of your report here, Urban Waterfronts and Planning for Industry. The reality in my mind is how do you have urban waterfronts blended with working waterfronts?
Mm-hmm.
Because that, to me, is one of the biggest issues we have, is the ability to continue. You made the reference to part of our success is focus. That's really, so we want to detract from that focus. We want to grow that focus and to be competitive. And, and the reality is one of the terms you use here is industry. You know, when you mention that in our community right now, in some groups, they think, well, that's your focus on fossil fuels. Well,
mm-hmm.
That's not what we really mean. And some way, somehow, and maybe in the future, somebody can invent a different term. It kind of reminds me, as a former Pierce County or Pierce College trustee, all of a sudden, vocational was bad. It's like, well, wait a minute. I think that's a good term, but the reality is now we got to talk about career and technical or whatever the term is. And all I'm saying is that it to me is we got to get better at describing what our real intent here is with our community. And so I appreciate everything.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I also, I know Friday afternoon is really tough. And just for the record, I'm off contract right now too. So I'm like, I feel very passionately committed to this work and to my students, where I know it's hard for them to come in, but I appreciate your time. And I definitely want to hear about factual inaccuracies. So sure. If there are things that you know are like, that is a red flag, don't put that out there.
You know how to get in touch with us just to get us a copy to look at, maybe give you a little feedback if that's
great.
Small groups of the commissioner would be to have a conversation on certain issues, because I get worried about the haves and have-nots. We talk about the journeyman process for welders and boilermakers and electricians. A lot of our population doesn't want to go through that 4 or 5 year torment either. So
right.
We have a lot of social issues that causes, it's not just industry or the changes, that we have a lot of social issues, because it's always embarrassing to have a firm come to town and have to have the county put an educational process together, third grade level, so you can provide the employees for that firm.
Yeah.
That's not something we should not celebrate that. In fact, I'd put on the back page where nobody could read that. But that is an issue.
Well, and I think these larger issues of trust between different communities and constituencies is not just something that we ought to be concerned about, but I think, like, even from a security perspective, increasingly people are looking at the quality of civic trust as a really important part of resilience, right? That you can't respond to a disaster if you've got factions in your community that can't talk to each other, or that don't trust authority, or are not engaging with, or have reason to distrust the large institutional actors in their region. So investing in those networks of trust is both the right thing to do, but it's also a really smart thing to do. And so we talk about resilience sometimes from a physical infrastructure standpoint. This kind of social infrastructure is also really
From my perspective, you know, I come back to the Foss Waterway is the gem. It's the diamond that the city of Tacoma has left and the port of Tacoma has left. It's a transition, a division point, but it's something that with careful planning and additional public access and honoring and respecting the necessity to create industrial-related jobs nearby, it's a critical piece for downtown Tacoma. You know, downtown Tacoma was largely separated from that waterway with Highway 705, but it's still accessible. And on the west side, there's been a lot done to create access and livability and the ability to enjoy the waterway, which I enjoy several days a week.
I need to get on that program.
Yeah, a paddling program.
Less time inside, more time outside.
Yeah. Anything else? Good. Thank you very much, Anna.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
We are now adjourned.